The feds offered help during an initial Flint area Legionnaires' disease outbreak back in 2014. The state decided it didn't need that help. The result, more people died because of another outbreak. I'm Lester Graham. Today on Stateside, we'll talk to the local official who wanted the CDC help. But first, yesterday on Stateside, Cynthia Canty spoke with Ann Arbor area officials about a plume of a toxic chemical called 1,4-dioxane. It's gradually spreading toward Ann Arbor's drinking water source. The Michigan Department of Environmental Quality is in charge of monitoring and determining what steps should be taken to prevent that pollution. It's really complicated. Earlier, we recorded an interview with Robert Wagner. He's the DEQ's Remediation and Redevelopment Division Chief. Let's start by taking this in chronological order. When and how did this toxic chemical get into the ground and start spreading?
Well, thanks, Lester. This started back in the 60s, 1966, to approximately 1986 when the Gilman Corporation used 1,4-dioxane in the manufacture of medical filters at their facility there in Ann Arbor. And releases occurred in a variety of ways at the facility as they were using it, including discharge through wastewater lagoons, which eventually reached the groundwater.
According to an article by Ryan Stanton with MLive, when Governor John Engler was in office, he signed a law that changed the allowable amount of dioxane in groundwater from 3 parts per billion and increased it to 85 parts per billion. Why did that happen?
Well, in 1995, the Michigan legislature amended the environmental remediation statute that governs cleanups across the state of Michigan with two notable changes. One is they changed the cancer risk factor from 1 in 1 million to 1 in 100,000. And then they allowed for the use of local ordinances or what are called institutional controls to manage risk associated with contaminated soil and groundwater. Thus, that allows parties to place restrictions on exposure to soil or groundwater, which then manages the risk. So no exposure, no risk to the public, and as a result, doesn't require a complete cleanup to what was known back then as non-detect. Of course, today we know we can detect things in soil and groundwater better than ever. You know, we've had over the course of 30 years, we've gone from parts per thousand to parts per million to parts per billion.
Well, we were measuring parts per billion in 1995. I mean, that was not uncommon. Did the DEQ ask for that change?
DEQ administers the law. So, no. I mean, we administered the law prior to 95, and we, of course, continue to administer it since the 95 amendments.
The EPA and other studies have indicated the allowable amount should be lower. The DEQ has been asked and said it would propose a lower standard to the legislature for a lot of different toxic chemicals. You've had years to do that. Why hasn't it happened?
Well, let me help you understand the complexity. In 1995, when the amendments went through...
Now, Mr. Wagner took 2 minutes and 41 seconds to answer this question. He went through 7 years of rulemaking process. If you want to hear it, it will be posted online. In the interest of getting to the point, we're skipping ahead.
So currently where we're at is we're very close to completing that comprehensive rule update, which will then go through the administrative rule promulgation process. It does not go directly to the legislature.
I think you'll understand that as people hear your explanation of this process, there's going to be some frustration because here is one of the biggest pollution problems in the state. It's threatening a major city's water supply. Why hasn't this been a higher priority? Wasn't there some way to fast track this?
Well, we're moving as fast as we can, and I expect that this rule package will be completed in 3.5 years rather than 7 years is what it took previously. But having said that, know that with respect to the city of Ann Arbor, no one is exposed or drinking 1,4-dioxane, nor has that happened. So while we clearly understand that people are concerned about it and they want to know what's going on, and they want to make sure their water is safe, as do we, which is one of our highest priorities to make sure they have safe drinking water, no one at the moment or in the near term is threatened with drinking water that would be contain 1,4-dioxane.
The information I have indicates private wells have been contaminated. The city of Ann Arbor has had to shut down one water intake. So what has to happen before there's real action and real cleanup?
Well, my understanding, the city voluntarily shut down that well. And they had their own lawsuit with Paul, and that was part of their agreement. With respect to the two wells that you mentioned, those are located in Scio Township. So specifically, we are aware of those, and we are prepared to take care of those locations in the event that the concentrations of 1,4-dioxane exceed either our current cleanup criteria or our new proposed cleanup criteria.
The DEQ came to a settlement with the company responsible for this dioxane plume. You accepted $500,000 from the former Gelman Sciences company, the Paul Corporation that you're talking about. That money was for past monitoring. DEQ, though, gave up the rights to ask for more monitoring or more money for the monitoring. Does that mean taxpayers are now on the hook for monitoring this toxic chemical slowly making its way to the Huron River where Ann Arbor gets its drinking water?
No. Paul Corporation does all of the monitoring of the groundwater and the movement of 1,4-dioxane in the groundwater.
How confident are you of getting correct data?
Well, we review that data, obviously, every time it comes in. We've been looking at trends with respect to concentrations for 20-some years, and so we're fairly confident that the data that we're receiving is representative of the conditions in the field.
What happens if the water is polluted, the drinking water for Ann Arbor is polluted? What's the contingency plan?
Well, typically, when groundwater supplies, individual water supplies are contaminated, if we have a responsible party, they provide safe water. If they don't, then the state of Michigan, DEQ, will provide safe water. In the event of a municipal system...
Let me stop you there. If they don't, aren't they obligated to? And if the DEQ supplies it, that means the taxpayers supply it.
That is correct, because we want to make sure people provide safe water first. After that all occurs, we sort out who pays, and that usually goes to court. So ultimately, a court will decide who pays.
You know, as you well know, because of the Flint water debacle, the public's confidence in the DEQ is badly shaken. I wonder how that affects your approach to this dioxane plume that threatens Ann Arbor's water sources.
Well, we've been dealing with groundwater contamination and private wells, community wells, and municipal well contamination, you know, since the late 70s. We have been providing bottled water to affected residents as soon as possible after detecting contamination in their well. We have been providing deeper wells, or we have been hooking people up to municipal water. We have worked with municipalities to protect their wells or to replace their wells using public funds for more than 30 years. So we will continue to do that, no change. One of our first priorities is to make sure the public has safe drinking water.
Okay, I want to go back to that question about the contingency plan. How would that happen? Because bottled water is great for drinking, but if you've got dioxane, is it safe to bathe in? Is it, you know, if it's not safe enough to drink, is it safe to use for anything?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, you know, toxicity of chemicals can vary considerably with respect to how you're exposed to them. So the 1,4-dioxane number, the lowest level is linked to ingestion. So the exposure route is that you drink it, and that number is very low. But for contact with skin, the number's higher. I don't know what it is right now, but it's not the lowest number. And so it's variable for all chemicals. Some chemicals won't be absorbed through your skin, so skin contact would not be a factor. Other chemicals are inhaled, and so that's the most risky pathway, and others is through ingestion. So, you know, if we wanted to get into dermal contact, I could get that number for you, but I don't have that right now.
I would like that number. Robert Wagner is the DEQ's Remediation and Redevelopment Division Chief. Thanks very much for talking with us.
You're welcome.
We heard back from Robert Wagner today regarding the skin exposure question. He wrote, quote, "The 1,4-dioxane dermal exposure number is 460 parts per billion. The equation used for this calculation assumes dermal exposure when performing routine household activities such as bathing, showering, washing clothes, and dishes for a 3-year exposure period," end quote. Stateside reached out to the corporation which owns the original plant site. Gelman Science was purchased by Paul Corporation, which was in turn purchased by Danaher last summer. We asked for a response to our coverage. We did not receive a statement by the agreed-upon deadline. Up next, how did Detroit become the Motor City? A new book looks at the history of car companies. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Detroit is the Motor City, but how did that happen? Why was Detroit the center of building cars and trucks? A new book looks at the history of car companies. It's called Lost Car Companies of Detroit. It was written by Alan Naldrit, who joins us now. So one of the fascinating things in this book, it brings out the huge number of car companies, how many failed or merged, or until we basically are left with the big three. And so I'm wondering, why was the automobile industry so volatile for so long?
The Motor City in Detroit, a lot of them made it here. We had two big guys, Ransom Olds and Henry Ford. And once they got going in the area, a lot of the car companies just converged onto Milwaukee Junction, which was the nexus of two railroad lines. So it was easy to ship parts in and out. Michigan had the lumber, and cars were made of lumber wood bodies at first. And so the local area had the raw materials that they needed. Plus, we're on the water, so we could get them easy.
Well, right away, you get to the rise of the Detroit Motor Car in 1897 with the formation of Olds Motor Vehicle Company. But you kind of have to backtrack to Lansing right away. Why is that?
Olds started his first factory in Detroit, but he went back to Lansing. He was from Lansing originally, and we're talking about basically a suburb of Detroit, right?
No, I don't think Lansing would agree with that.
No, but Lansing and Olds pretty much had a lot of connection to the Detroit area. It was the factory he started in. When he shipped them out, he sent them to Detroit. It was still the nexus of the area. And then all the companies converging on the Milwaukee Junction, Michigan people got along well together, unlike the other states where they didn't share the information like we did in Detroit. So you have all these really lot of auto geniuses, but they're going from company to company, and they're taking the information, they're improving as they go along, which had a lot to do maybe with our local version, which was we got the gasoline engine going. That was our thing pretty much, and we improved that, and we made it go fast.
Right, talking about going from one popper to two popper to four popper in really fast order.
Yes, exactly.
I want to ask you about the Studebaker Company, chiefly because that was my favorite pickup truck that my dad owned when I was a kid. The Studebaker Company, like a lot of the early car companies, started out as a horse-drawn buggy company in Indiana. How did it end up building cars in Detroit?
Studebaker a beautiful car, too. The Studebaker brothers were the largest, not one of the largest, the largest, most people say, buggy maker in the area. They started in that South Bend, Indiana area. And Wheelbarrow Johnny, as he was called, was the younger Studebaker brother. made his fortune kind of in the gold era, taking his wheelbarrow and selling things to the people that were in California area from the gold rush. He took the money back and talked his brothers into designing a car. And so they did cars and buggies for a while. And after a while, the cars took over. Studebaker was, even though I said South Bend, Indiana, moved to Detroit very soon with their cars. And the big factory that burned in 2002, which also made EMF at one time, was right across from the Paquette plant in the Milwaukee Junction. And shame that that one burned down. But they were also in the Paquette factory after Ford moved out of it.
Now, Studebaker eventually merged or bought out Packard. A lot of folks in Michigan are familiar with the abandoned Packard plant in Detroit. How did that merger happen, and what became of those two brands?
Well, without mentioning Roy C. Chapin, who was started here at Michigan in one of the fraternity houses where he met Howard Coffin and a lot of the other people that he formed Hudson with. But Roy C. Chapin had Hudson, and eventually Hudson and Nash, another successful company on its own, wanted Packard to join them in forming a super company, kind of. I think they approached Studebaker, but Studebaker didn't have a great cash position at the time. But they wanted Packard because Packard did have a great cash position. And George Mason was the head of Nash, Kelvinator. He had really brought the company up. Everybody wanted him to run the whole shebang, and except for James L. Nance, the president of Packard, who I call the king of hubris, because he would not let that company go ahead without him being president. And everybody was like, it would be great, but we cannot have Nance for our president. And sure enough, they did not merge. 2 years later, Nance was sniffing around and needed some help. And that's when Studebaker came a-calling. And Packard and Studebaker coexisted kind of for 2 years. They would put out Packard still and Studebakers, but that didn't last long. Pretty soon, they moved out of the Packard factory into South Bend. I think the transition was pretty sudden, and of course we know the Packard factory now, and at the same time we know in South Bend that they existed. Studebaker for a while longer went out of business there. For a little while longer, they even had a Windsor factory that was the last one to go.
Now, Henry Ford gets a lot of credit for mass producing affordable vehicles with the Ford Motor Company, but you note that Ford Motor Company was his third car company that he'd failed before. Can you tell us about that?
Well, the first company, you don't get a lot of information on it. I think Child Wills was just kind of an acquaintance at that time. And once Child Wills and Ford got together, that's when the action started. But the first company, he didn't think the car was very good, and he just dissolved it. You don't hear a lot about that one. The second company, I believe, was the one on Warren, which was a wooden building. We have pictures of it. It burned down. But the third factory he had was the Paquette factory. But the second company, let me note that Henry Ford had a difference of opinion with a few of the others. In fact, one of them was Henry Leland, who had been brought in, another auto genius who had designed his own motor. Then when Ford disengaged from the company, Leland was still there, and he took those other guys that were going to finance Ford and talked him into sticking with him and financing the car he had designed called the Cadillac. And so that became Cadillac Motor Company, later purchased, but at one time and a long time, a very successful independent company.
There were a lot of companies, about 200 that you mentioned in the book. The list is long. You named a lot of them. There was Nash, Baker, Wayne, Pierce Arrow, Tucker, Kaiser, Dodge, Chevrolet, Hudson. So what's your favorite? What's your favorite story among those?
Oh, it's hard to pick a favorite, but if I had to pick a favorite duo, it would, of course, be the Dodge brothers, who would...
They were a little rambunctious, I understand.
Yes, that's true. They would go out drinking. They had untold wealth. They were very wealthy from being in on Ford's successful third company from the start, doing the prototypes, designing and making transmissions and lots of major parts. And they would go out at night and celebrate, and that would include many times they would trash the bar, and they would go back the next day, and if they could remember where they were, they'd pay for the damage. They did tend to choose bars that were out in the middle of nowhere, kind of, and were ramshackle to begin with. So maybe they were kind of thinking, when I trash this bar, at least it won't cost me as much as when I trashed the Penobscot bar, for instance.
Exactly. Alan Aldred is the author of The Lost Car Companies of Detroit. It's published by The History Press. Thanks very much for coming in. It's been fun.
Well, thank you very much.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham.
55 years ago was this young 12-year-old boy. All he wanted to do was to belong.
And now a story from Failure Lab by Bing Goey, director of the Michigan Office for New Americans.
Hello, Grand Rapids. How's everybody tonight? My name is Bing Goey, and I can't believe that I'm standing here on this stage talking to a full house, talking about my failure, and believing Jonathan that tells me I will really enjoy this experience. But that's part of my failure, my most recent failure. I believe Jonathan. But what I want to talk to you about tonight is, I want to take you back 55 years ago. I know that most of you weren't even born then. But 55 years ago, two things happened in my life that had a dramatic impact on what I've become. 55 years ago, I think we became the first Chinese family that made the front page of the Grand Rapids Press. January 9, 1960 is the date of this front page. And in this corner, right here, is a picture of a Chinese family arriving in Grand Rapids. My family, my parents, and their seven children. 55 years ago. But another event occurred in that year, an event that dramatically changed my life. A failure that I didn't even realize was a failure until 25-some years later. You see, 55 years ago was this young 12-year-old boy. All he wanted to do was to belong, to be a part of. But you know, 55 years ago in Grand Rapids, that was tough for this Chinese boy. It was tough because I had to listen to classmates talk about Ching Chong Chinaman, who pulled their eyes on the sides and pretend like they were Chinese. All I wanted to was to belong. I mean, I thought I was kind of fun. I liked good grades, especially if I had a dad that wanted me to have good grades. I like sports. Heck, even at that time, I liked girls. But what was it? What was it? What was the answer? I was looking for an answer that allowed me to be part of, to belong to a group. It was a few months into my school year there in which a classmate of mine came to me, someone that I considered a friend. And he said to me, "Bing, you're okay. You're okay. But you have to watch out for those Negroes." Bingo, I had my answer. I'm fine. As long as I am willing to remember that I have to watch out for those Negroes. For the next 25 years, 25 plus years, I absorbed all the information, all the things that the news media told me, all the things that the schools told me in their history books, all the things that the church would tell me about the Negroes, that allowed me to say, "Yes, I'm okay. I'm okay. I just have to watch out for those Negroes." What was so discouraging is that I lived that life for 25 plus years. And my failure to challenge that statement from my sixth grade classmate, I didn't even realize at that time how much not only I was hurt by believing it, but how much I hurt him by not challenging it. Just think, for 25 plus years, I allowed him to make the same assumptions, the same statements to the thousands of people that became part of his life. I stood by silently for over 25 plus years in which I watched the news media portray the Negroes, in which I watched our unjust legal system break down the families of those Negroes that I had to watch for, in which I had to watch in which the high unemployment rates in the Negro communities, because you know, they were the last hired and always the first fired. I had to watch a school system that never talked about the contributions that Negroes made to the quality of life for white and brown people. How many of you know who invented, who started the blood bank? The traffic light, the incandescent light bulb. Schools didn't teach that. We didn't know. And then the church, the city of churches where the Judeo-Christian beliefs is that because the Negroes are descendants of Ham, they didn't deserve the blood of the Savior. For 25 years, I absorbed all that. And I thought, I'm okay. I'm okay. Until it knocked on my door. Because you see, in the late 1980s, around 86, 87, my father came to me. I was a grown man at that time. I had a family. My father came to me with tears in his eyes, and I never, never saw my father cry. And he shared with me, and I said to him, "Dad, what are you crying about?" Then he shared with me the humiliation, the discrimination that he had to endure. And I began to think, what did my silence do that caused him that much pain? What did my failure do to not challenge that I knew probably was not right, but I was self-consumed by wanting to be okay? Are you okay?
That was Bing Goey, director of the Michigan Office for New Americans, telling his story of failure. We'll hear more of these stories on Stateside from our partners at Failure Lab. Listen to more stories at failure-lab.com. Coming up, a new study finds a link between sleep deprivation and false confessions.
There's substantial evidence that certain areas of the brain that are critical to executive function and decision making show reduced activation during sleep deprivation.
We speak with one of the researchers. Then we talk to the Genesee County health official who asked the CDC for help with an investigation into Flint's deadly Legionnaires' disease outbreak. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. So let's say you're charged with a crime. The police are interrogating you. I mean, for a long time they're interrogating you and you haven't had any sleep. There is a new study which indicates you might falsely confess because you're sleep deprived. That study was published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, and one of the authors joins us now. Kim Fenn is an associate professor of psychology at Michigan State University. So you and your co-authors wrote an article for The Conversation about this study, and you noted false confessions are a factor in about 25% of DNA exonerations in the U.S. Why would anybody confess to something they didn't do?
I think it's really difficult for anyone to believe that this could actually happen, but it happens with alarming frequency, and in fact, we don't even know how often it happens. In response to your question, I'm not sure that I know why people do this. What we do know is that a lot of times these confessions occur, as you said, after lengthy interrogations, and sometimes even with coercive police interrogation tactics.
Your study found sleep-deprived subjects would confess more often than those who had adequate sleep in the experiment you ran. Tell me about how you set up that.
Our participants all came in for an initial session, and during that session, we warned them that they were not permitted to hit a certain key on the keyboard, in this case, the escape key. And this is modeled after other research that has looked at false confessions in an experimental laboratory. Now, importantly, the escape key on a standard PC keyboard is very far from the other keys, so it's unlikely that they would have accidentally hit the key. So it's not like the caps lock key that you would just, you know, often potentially hit by accident.
Right.
So we warned them that they should not touch this key, then we tell them that it will cause us to lose valuable research data. We then brought them back to the laboratory approximately 1 week later. And at that time, we told them that they would either be able to sleep for a night in our laboratory, we have two bedrooms here, or that they would be required to stay awake for the entire night. So again, that night, we warned them of our escape key problem, and then we told them which condition they would be. And so then they either went to sleep, and we set them up with full polysomnography, so we were able to trace their sleep throughout the night, so we know that they actually did sleep and for how long they slept and that sort of thing. And then the other participants remained awake in the laboratory. They were monitored by two research staff who had napped during the day, so they were a little bit less sleepy than the participants. And then the critical element of the study is on the following morning, after which half of participants had stayed awake for the entire night and half had slept. We accused them of hitting this escape key in their first session in the laboratory.
You lied to them.
We did lie to them.
So what was the difference in the confessions between those who had enough sleep and those who didn't?
Yeah, the difference was quite alarming. Of the participants who slept throughout the night, about 18% of them confessed to our allegation. However, in the sleep-deprived conditions, that number went up to 50%. So a full half of the participants agreed that they had done this thing that they did not
talk
do.
I want to talk about a flaw or a weakness in your experiment that I read about in Scientific Method. Mm-hmm. They said the participants didn't face any penalty for signing the confessions. What do you think about that criticism?
I think that's an absolutely valid criticism, actually. I mean, this is actually one of the steps that we're going to take next. Obviously, in a real confession, if you confess to a murder or a double murder, as has been done, inherently you know that something could potentially happen to you. And here, there were no consequences. So I do agree that that's absolutely a weakness of the study.
So how do you think, based on what you've learned here, how do you think this plays out in the real world where law enforcement is working to get a suspect to confess to a crime?
Mm-hmm. I think it could have potentially really dire consequences in that there's a lot of research and a lot of literature to suggest that in a sleep-deprived state, individuals have impaired cognitive ability across a range of tasks, importantly including things like decision making. There's also substantial evidence that certain areas of the brain that are critical to executive function and decision making, and importantly the frontal lobes, show reduced activation during sleep deprivation. What you're essentially doing is taking a person who is not at the peak or in fact is impaired in their cognitive processing, and you can put them in a state in which these sorts of false confessions may be much more likely to occur.
The next step, what needs to be done to verify that sleep deprivation might contribute to false confessions?
There's a lot to be done. I mean, quite honestly, this is just the first step in what should be a long line of research. One of the very important things that needs to be done is to impose some consequences. So let people know that if they falsely confess to this thing, or that if they confess to this thing, this behavior, whatever it is, that something bad will happen to them. And I think another interesting thing that we need to do is to look at the difference between the effect of sleep deprivation on false confessions and also on true confessions. It's unknown whether or not sleep deprivation makes people more or even less likely to confess to something that they've actually done or a crime they've actually committed.
Kimberly Finn is co-author of a study that suggests sleep deprivation can lead to false confessions. It was published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Last Saturday, CNN ran an exclusive report entitled "Michigan Legionnaires' Deaths Were Preventable," official says. CNN investigative correspondent Sarah Ganim reported how a local official in Flint asked the Centers for Disease Control, the CDC, to investigate an outbreak of Legionnaires' disease. The CDC contacted Michigan state officials.
But the CDC tells CNN that it felt a comprehensive investigation was warranted and offered to further assist Michigan. In this case, Michigan felt that they had the skills and resources needed to perform the investigation themselves.
The CDC cannot investigate unless a state makes a request. The result? More people died because of an additional Legionnaires outbreak. The local official who asked for the CDC help is Jim Henry. He is the Genesee County Health Director, and he joins us now. So let's start from the beginning. When did you first confirm there was a Legionnaires case in Genesee County?
The first time we noticed that there was an increase in Legionnaires disease relative to previous years was in August of 2014.
So there was a spike that year. How many people became ill and how many died in that first outbreak?
There were 45 illnesses and there were 5 deaths.
When did you ask the CDC for help?
Well, we asked the CDC for help in March of 2015. In February of 2015, we made contact with Dr. Janice Stout from Pittsburgh to gain information regarding the Legionella experiences that she's had and to learn more about the City of Flint distribution system.
When you learned the state had refused CDC help to investigate this Legionnaires outbreak, what did you think of that?
We thought it was a mistake. We saw new cases, and the only reasonable explanation for that is that it must have been a mistake, and that was conveyed in a response, in an email, in response to the executive summary that determined the outbreak was over. We identified the new cases in our response, so it's clear that the outbreak was not over.
So Michigan state officials say they helped your office. They say CDC was part of the conversation. They determined that the outbreak was over by the data and resources they had. Why do you think it ended there? Why did they say the outbreak was over?
Well, it's interesting because at the time we were working with the Center for Disease Control. They were in the process of sending a team of experts to Genesee County to help us identify the source. Part of that is being able to isolate the bacteria from the patient, and that's challenging. There was a lot of mistakes made in that process, but you need to have that clinical isolate before you can compare it to the environmental sources, the suspected sources.
So you didn't have necessarily the technical expertise, and Michigan's agency wasn't offering you the help to get that information. That's something that the CDC team really needed to do. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. We needed the expertise to isolate that clinical specimen. And The Center for Disease Control, they were assembling, they were ready to come here to help, and that's when that process was stopped on June 8th. And Department of Health and Human Services wrote in another email to this entire team, which included the EPA, the Center for Disease Control, Genesee County Health Department, and some of the experts, independent experts, that the failure to match the clinical isolate with the environmental source precludes our ability to further the investigation.
So DHHS said, we've got this, don't worry about it, we think it's all over anyway. Then how many people got sick and how many died after that?
There were several cases before and after June 4th when the determination that the outbreak was over.
I'm wondering, why didn't you sound the alarm then? You run part of the health department. You could have put out a warning to the people of Genesee County and to Flint that there's this problem. We've got a spike in Legionnaires' disease. It might be connected to the Flint River. We don't know that yet, but take precautions.
Part of the problem was it was sporadic. There were cases throughout the community, throughout Genesee County. It wasn't limited to the city of Flint. One thing that we did see as a trend was the hospital system. And that's one of the areas that we focused our efforts was because this is a vulnerable population within the hospital, and we need to make sure that those people are protected. We began working immediately with the infectious disease people at the McLaren Hospital. We began working with their environmental health and safety division director, and we requested that they hire Dr. Janet Stout to come in and end their situation. They had found Legionella in their water system, and
are they
needed to be mitigated.
McLaren is getting their water from the Flint distribution system.
That is correct.
Okay.
Yep. We did post a fact sheet on our website. We did share it with our partners within the community. There's been some mention of a health alert through the MIHAN system, Michigan Health Alert Network. The Health Alert Network is designed to communicate with other local health departments, state agencies, and hospital systems and physicians. That does not send a public message.
Right.
So I think there's some misunderstanding. And in Genesee County, there is only 3 physicians that use the Health Alert Network.
So you notified health officials, but you didn't feel the need to notify the public?
We notified the public by sharing the fact sheet throughout the community and posting it on our website. It's challenging when you don't have the source. You don't have a definitive source. The challenge is if we say McLaren Hospital appears to be making people ill and we can't support that, it wouldn't be fair to the hospital system.
Right, it would sully their reputation. Let me ask you this. Considering everything that's gone on, what would you have done differently? What would you want to have happened differently in this situation?
I wish we would have been more prepared.
In what way?
We did not see this coming. We recognized that there was problems within the distribution system because there were brown water events. There were boil water advisories. There were, odors, and then they put a bunch of chlorine, the city added chlorine to the distribution system to control bacteria. But this is not our expertise. This is not what we do. The state has jurisdiction.
Do you think...
I've learned a lot about municipal water, but prior to 2014, this is all new territory for me.
Do you think the fact that the DHHS did not request a CDC team to come in and help Genesee County, that resulted in those 9 deaths in Genesee County from Legionnaires' disease?
I think that those deaths could have been avoided. I think in the year 2015, we could have prevented those deaths had the Center for Disease Control been able to help us. That didn't happen. The state made that decision.
You work for a government agency, and you work with government agencies. What has this experience done to your confidence in government agencies?
Relative to the state, there are many competent, hardworking people that are employed by the state of Michigan. There are a handful of people that are in administrative positions that shouldn't be. They've made some very poor decisions, regardless of their motive, that have caused people to suffer. I think they should be relieved of their authority. I'm not saying they need to be fired, but if they're still in a position that has influence on the response to the city of Flint, they should be reassigned. And if they don't need to be involved with this, if they helped create it. They do not need to be involved with response if they're the people that helped create it. There's a conflict, and it's significant.
I want to ask you one final question. You've got a different water source. You're getting it from Detroit now rather than the Flint River. Do you think this summer we can avoid another outbreak of Legionnaires' disease?
We're concerned. We are very concerned. There's a different source, but the organic carbon that is food for the microorganisms is still in the system. There's still areas where the water moves very slowly. There's dead ends. There's areas where the chlorine residual is very low.
So you're saying some Legionella bacteria could survive, and you've got to be careful and monitor that carefully.
Yes. And we're working with a team of people right now to test the distribution system for Legionella, find out where it is and how to destroy it so it will not cause problems in 2016. So we will not be, we're trying to prevent this now. We know Legionella is a warm weather bug, and we've seen, in 2015, we started seeing the cases in May. And then in June, one after another. And we need to be prepared.
I'm going to make a personal observation. You seem really tired and a little stressed. Is this all starting to get to you?
I think our whole team at Genesee County Health Department is tired and stressed. You're right. I'm tired. I work all, this is what we do. I go knock on people's doors to make sure they're not drinking elevated water,
right,
lead in their water. You know, I go do presentations for my, you know, yeah, and I stay up all night putting a presentation together because I can't find it. I haven't done my payroll, and I got to do that right now or my staff won't get paid. It's, yeah, there's just not enough time in the day. So, yeah, I'm pretty tired. I'm stressed. So is everybody else around here. But what we're doing, we have a solid team, and I think we're going to be able to prevent this from happening again. But we need to start right now. We can't wait. If we do, then we didn't do everything we could do to stop it. We have to start right now and make sure this doesn't happen again.
Jim Henry is the Environmental Health Supervisor at Genesee County Health Department. Thanks very much for talking with us.
You're welcome.
Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Cass Adair, Allie Billings, Mike Blank, Emily Fox, Josh Hakala, Sean McHenry, and Mercedes Mejia. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening.